Are you ready to wake up to a new you? Welcome to the radio that empowers you to heal you. Keisha Ewers is here to share 25 years of frontline medicine, bringing you the newest medical research, tempered with the holistic wisdom of Ayurveda. All so you can be the best you can be. And now your host, Keisha Ewers.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Healthy You Radio. This is Keisha Ewers, your wellness coach. And good afternoon, Valerie.
Good afternoon, Keisha. How are you?
I'm good. It was Valentine's Day on Sunday. My son turned 19. He's a Valentine's baby, so we had a great time.
Oh, well, happy birthday to him.
Yeah. Did you have a good Valentine's Day?
I did. I had to work, so I celebrated Thanksgiving on Thursday.
Thanksgiving?
Or Valentine's Day.
You are so way behind.
Valentine's and Thursday at the same time. It came out Thanksgiving. Valentine's, I had to celebrate it on Thursday. So.
All right. Well, you know what? You had to work with a pep in your voice, right? You had to work. It was exciting. It was a fun day. Yes. So we're going to talk about love and happiness because of our Valentine's theme here. And I'm going to talk about it today from a hormonal perspective. So we're going to talk about hormones for our health tip of the week. So let's talk about it. Most of us are living a life that's completely out of balance, and I've talked about this before from very many perspectives, but let me just ask you about your mood, your energy. Do they swing up and down? Does your life feel a little bit crazy because you can't get a real stable, you know, beat on that? Do you crave sugar? Do you crave salt? Are you overweight, putting on more belly fat? If you're a woman, do you have PMS or painful heavy periods or bad menopausal symptoms? Are you depressed? Do you sleep badly? Are you less interested in sex? Do you have thin hair, dry skin, or you feel sluggish in the morning and can't get up? And do you feel wired but tired and have to drink coffee all the time to get yourself to go and wine to get yourself to slow down? This is kind of an American scenario that I just drew. And so you're not alone if this is what's happening.
That's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of stuff. Do you recognize any of it?
Yes.
So this is what happens when we're living out of harmony with our natural biological rhythms and our hormones are all over the place. So I'm going to let our guest for today, who's the author of Buddha's Brain, talk about their neurological, the neurohormones, and the brain and its effect on love and happiness. But today I'm going to cover our mental misery of stress hormones and thyroid hormones and sex hormones and our major blood sugar control hormone called insulin. So the first one is the insulin. Now, mind you, all these hormones, including the brain hormones, work all together, so it's known as the endocrine system. But each gland has its own set of hormones that they're in charge of. So it gets a little bit crazy because the body really craves what we call homeostasis or balance. And if one gland gets out of whack, then the others rush in and try to help. So if you find that you're having cravings for sugar or bread, or you feel weak and irritable around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and this, I can definitely say, I used to have this. I would go mining for chocolate chips in my house about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when I was raising my kids, and it was terrible. It's like a chocolate bloodhound. I could sniff it out for miles away. If you skip breakfast or you eat a big muffin or a bagel for breakfast or you have extra belly fat, then you likely have some blood sugar insulin problems, which can cause depression and dementia and anxiety, which is a lot of what I deal with at Fern Life Center at my clinic. So now here's a little test. Look down at your belly. Everybody look down at your belly. And if it's sticking out or if it jiggles when you jump up and down, you have a problem. It's not supposed to be that way. So we've seen this really extraordinary increase in sugar consumption in the last 100 years. So we've gone from 10 pounds of sugar per person, okay, 10 pounds per year of sugar consumption in the 19th century to 158 pounds per person per year at the beginning of the 21st century.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Do the math on that. From 10 pounds to 158 pounds.
And where is that coming from? Like soda, sugar, and coffee,
yes,
maybe?
Or? Yes. All of those are right. Gold star. And guess what? We spend more money at gas stations on junk food than we do on gas. And we spend more money on processed and junk food than we spend on new cars, new computers, and higher education combined.
Wow, that's amazing.
Think about that. Combined, we spend more money on food that I always say, this is I always say, you always just poop out your food. Why do you spend so much money on it? And really, don't waste money on stuff that is doing you harm. So
that's a good way of looking at it.
That's right. That's why 100 million Americans suffer from insulin resistance or prediabetes. And this is a problem that's causing what we now call pre-dementia, or a mild cognitive impairment we also affectionately call brain fog. So some scientists are now calling Alzheimer's diabetes type 3, and we usually only have 1 and 2, and we're starting to diagnose children very young with type 2 diabetes, which used to be labeled adult onset diabetes. And so my question is, could this mean that we're going to be getting Alzheimer's in this generation of kids at the age of 30 and 40? Instead of where we're, you know, usually are, which is in the 50, 60, 70 range. So this is kind of scary. So what do we do about it? Balance your blood sugar by cutting out flour and sugar, especially high fructose corn syrup. Everybody look at the labels of everything you eat, and you will see high fructose corn syrup in almost everything that's processed. So please cut that out. It'll make a big difference. And then eat whole foods and make sure you have protein with your breakfast, like eggs or nuts or a protein shake. And then don't forget to get moving. Really, exercise is a magic potion for the brain and your belly fat. So, and then hormonal imbalance number 2, I was talking about thyroid hormones. This affects 1 in 5 women and 1 in 10 men, and most of them don't even know they have it. So if you're cold all the time, if you have dry skin, thin hair, weak fingernails, a puffy face, swelling in your hands and feet, constipation, or trouble getting in and out of bed in the morning, do you seem to forget things easily? This could be thyroid. So you need actually help from a very good trained doctor or nurse practitioner who really knows thyroid hormones and can help you. So get properly tested and then get enough thyroid supportive nutrients that are, you know, selenium, zinc, vitamin D, omega-3 fats, and iodine. And then you really do need to take thyroid hormone replacement if your tests show that they're not optimally balanced. In my tradition of, you know, yoga and meditation, which we're going to talk about that a little later today, there's really great breathing exercises you can do to stimulate your thyroid too. So somebody that's trained in that, meditation can help with thyroid balancing, and we will talk about that a little later. All right, the next hormone imbalance that we can have are our reproductive hormone imbalances or sex hormones. So why do sex hormone levels drop up to 90% as we age? So a lot of times in the United States, we think that this is normal. Erectile dysfunction is normal. Loss of libido is normal. Are we destined to suffer from impaired mood, muscle loss, poor memory, sleep difficulties? No. This is because not of bad luck or bad genes, but bad habits. Yeah, we don't like to hear that, do we? Bad habits like drinking and smoking, eating a high sugar, refined carbohydrate diet, and being exposed to environmental toxins and chronically stressed. So again, a lot of the material that we cover with our guests today, this little teaser I keep throwing out there, we will talk about how to reduce our stress and how our bodies actually cope with it. So then PMS and menopausal symptoms are all signs of imbalances in your sex hormones too. So ladies, if you have headaches and breast tenderness and fluid retention and mood swings and irritability, my family always knows when I'm about to go there, on the days or weeks before your menstrual period, you might have too much estrogen and not enough progesterone. And this is also another signal that you've been under stress for a long time and your ovaries are being stolen from your adrenals. And this can make you feel crazy. So we know that sugar and caffeine and alcohol and stress and a lack of exercise all contribute to or worsen PMS and menopausal symptoms. But it's also true that dairy consumption does. And this is always a big aha to people that I work with. They can't figure out why organic milk, because it's not supposed to have all of the steroids and hormones in it, could possibly cause problems. But even organic milk can come from pregnant cows, which actually increases your hormones, right? So there are milk substitutes you can use, like rice milk. It's a good one. And then you can get your calcium, which we're always worried about, from green leafy vegetables. There's a lot of calcium in spinach. So eat a diet, again, of whole foods, low in sugar, refined carbs, caffeine, and alcohol. Do I start sounding like a broken record?
No, not at all.
When you go to the gas station, just pump gas. That's it. Wash your windshield. Don't buy processed food. Load up on broccoli, all those good green leafies, and then supplement with vitamin B6 and magnesium and evening primrose oil and fish oil, and then get a lot of exercise. Balancing your hormones is a process, and so it never goes as quickly as we all want it to. And the thing that I tell my patients is, it took a long time to get where you are today, and it's going to take a while to get you out. So you have to have patience and make sure you go to a qualified medical provider, please. You can go to www.fernlifecenter.com and look up the program there, or find someone close to you that is trained to use all of these things. All right, gotta move on. Gotta move on. So my guest today is going to give us all even more tips for balancing our hormones, starting with our neurotransmitter hormones in our brains, which actually lead to a balanced endocrine system downstream. Dr. Rick Hansen is the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. He's a neuropsychologist, a meditation teacher, and a weekly contributor to psychologytoday.com. He's written and taught extensively about the essential inner skills of personal well-being, psychological growth, and contemplative practice, as well as about relationships, family life, and raising children. And he's the founder for the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. Welcome to Healthy You Radio, Rick.
Thank you very much.
I think we caught you in the middle of a walkabout down under with your father, did we not?
That's exactly right. 91 years old. My dad is. I'm not. And we were in Australia where my brother lives with his wife. And it's a fantastic country down there. I recommend people see it if they can.
I lived there for a few months and just loved it. Just really, really loved it. Lots of sun.
Tons of sun. You know, it's not usually that you get off the plane in Hawaii where we landed on our return from Australia and step out of the plane and go, oh, it's a lot less humid here. It's pretty darn humid. On the other hand, you've got crazy stuff like kangaroos literally coming up to your car looking for a handout, bouncing around, and strange birds, huge water lizards, and incredibly friendly and mellow people.
Oh, I know. It's so much fun to travel there. And they have emus. I loved emus and cassowaries. Great birds. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I promised that we would talk about love today and what the brain's role is in love. So we'll have you explain that to our listeners.
Okay,
you're listening
great.
To Healthy You Radio. This is Keisha Yours.
But for now, feel burned out and stressed? You can be happy, alive, and energetic. Learn to meditate from world-renowned meditation instructor Ajahn Boris and come away knowing how to cope with your stress. The Power of Being meditation class is not just about relieving stress. It's about living full out, living your full creative potential. Call today to register for a one-day course in your area. Toll free, 877-391-3376. That's 877-391-3376. Or email info@fernlifecenter.com. The class is for everyone, even beginners. If you want to beat your high blood pressure, insomnia, depression, or addictions, call now, toll free, 877-391-3376. That's 877-391-3376. February 20th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Is your romantic relationship lacking zest? Are you having trouble remembering what the reasons were that made you fall in love with this person in the first place? Keisha Yours and Ajahn Boris will teach you to have the partnership you have always wanted. Make your relationship a pathway to the sacred through the ancient practice of Tantra, or seeing God in everything and everyone around you. Learn techniques to heighten your awareness and bring juice back to your love life. Relationship is the ultimate path to growth and can bring great joy as well as great pain. Keisha and Ajahn will teach you how to use your partnership as a catalyst for growth. Start your journey by booking a workshop in your area. Call 425-391-3376 or log on to www.fernlifecenter.com. Call now to book a class of 10 or more couples and you will receive your tuition free. Have the sex life and love you have only dreamed of. Call today, 425-391-3376.
Information provided on the Healthy You radio show is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for the advice provided by your physician or other healthcare professional. You should not use the information from the broadcast of the radio show for diagnosing or treating a health problem, disease, or prescribing any medication or other treatment.
Negativity and fear, two staples of talk radio. Well, we figured we'd try something different. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back to Healthy You Radio. This is Keisha Yours, joined today by Dr. Rick Hansen, who's the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. So I had promised our listeners at the top of the hour here that we would talk about love today and what the brain's role is in love. So why don't we just start with that?
Okay. Well, love is very complicated, as we all know, and it has its own rhythms and its own roller coaster. So anything I say here about the brain is, of course, just part of the story. But that said, there are, I guess what I'm immediately thinking of is MRI shots. And MRI, as you know, is an image of the brain actually in action. And these are MRI pictures of college sophomores, you know, the primary research subjects of most psychological studies, who are deeply in love looking at a photograph of their beloved, all right? And what's interesting is that in their brain, one of the parts of the brain that particularly lights up, as it were, because it's differentially active. In other words, it's about 3%, it's using about 3% more oxygen than other parts of the brain nearby, but that's a difference that makes a big difference. And you can see it on an MRI. Anyway, the part that's lit up is the pleasure center, the caudate nucleus, it's called, a major pleasure center of the brain that also activates when people win the lottery or take cocaine. Now, we're not equating being in love with, you know, doing crack, but it is interesting that many of the same systems, you know, that are involved in that kind of great pleasure are also involved in certainly the early stages of being in love, at least when you're in college. Another neurotransmitter and hormone that you know well, of course, is oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
That it gets very involved in the, I'd say, more mature stages of love. It's there in the beginning during the kind of lust phase, but it particularly gets involved in long-term love and relationships, both romantic between mates and also between parents and children. It's kind of that let's get close, skin-to-skin contact neurotransmitter and hormone, you know, that just feels really great. I will say in passing, having just celebrated my wedding anniversary on Valentine's Day, my wife said, this way you'll never forget our anniversary. It's a gender slur, and I have to live with it. But anyway, you know, there are some couples who still get that same light up of the pleasure center of the brain, you know, when they see each other. And I'm kind of happy to say I think I'm still, my wife and I are still in that zone. But there is hope. There is hope for us all.
That is wonderful. And I know that Valentine's Day brings up some bad feelings for some people that have had bad memories, because memory plays a big part in how we feel and what happens in our brain. And I always tell people, it doesn't matter if you don't have a significant other or a partner or a love interest, you can actually get oxytocin released by going and having a massage, you know. Get your friend that you are going to the movie with. You guys can give each other shoulder rubs, you know, and release all that stuff coming out of your muscles and loosen up and release oxytocin, because it's released through touch.
Yeah. So. I think that's wonderfully true. And I'm glad you said it, because it reminds me of the whole idea that there's an interesting body of research now on self-compassion. And it's the idea that we can give ourselves the kind of attunement and also care and concern that maybe was in short supply when we were young, or in short supply in, you know, our last marriage or love relationship. And it's the idea that deep down in the brain, those circuits don't know what the source is of the tender concern and goodwill that's coming in, or the sense of being present with oneself. And so whether it's coming from, you know, Susie Smith or John Smith out there in the world, or from inside our own head. So mm-hmm. if people do things like bring an attitude of wishing that they not suffer, combined with a kind of sympathetic concern, that's the essence of compassion, if they bring that to themselves, then they can heal a lot of wounds inside. And I think for me that gets to the larger point that, you know, it's important to do what we can with the world out there, right? I mean, that's important. I have a business background, actually, and I'm a practical guy. But on the other hand, boy, our impact on the world is very limited, really. You know, as Sartre, the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said, hell is other people, right? You know, people come and go. I mean, they do what they do, for better or for worse. But the place where you actually have a lot more power is inside your own head. So that's why I wanted to write a book that was really a kind of an operating manual for what you could do these days, informed by both science and the contemplative traditions, inside your own head, you know, in the 3 pounds of tofu between the ears, to have more happiness, love, and wisdom.
I was so, so happy when I read your book and I saw that you talked about self-compassion. That's one of the modules that I teach at my clinic, is self-compassion. And one of the things I always tell my patients is, you know, compassion given to another person, if you don't have self-compassion, is only coming from the ego. It's not real. It's done with a hope for a payback or reciprocity. But if you've got a well inside of your own heart that's full, that's that self-compassion, that, and you're good at giving yourself compassion, and then you actually can genuinely, authentically have empathy for another person.
Yeah.
and dole that out to them. And that's really important. So I would like to actually back up, and let's talk about, you know, you talk about you can use your mind to change your brain for the better. And there was a really great line in your new book, which you said, when neurons fire together, they wire together. Can you explain this? And let's just talk about the brain for a few minutes.
Yeah, sure. Well, let's see. That saying is actually from the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, who is a real groundbreaker. And he developed a theory and proved it, that it's, and other people have proved it as well, that when we have thought or emotions or any other form of mental activity, most of which is actually nonverbal, and most mental activity is outside the field of awareness even. So as information moves to the nervous system, in other words, as signals travel through the nervous system headquartered in the brain, they actually change the nervous system as they go. For example, if you record a song, you're actually changing the information that you're putting into your computer, let's say, or your iPod, is actually changing the hardware there. And the same thing happens in the brain. It's just that we have a lot more control over it. And so when neurons are busy and when they connect to each other, they actually start reaching out to each other. I imagine the finger of God and Adam kind of coming together at the top of the Sistine Chapel. The synapses reach for each other and make these wonderful connections. And they do it through mental activity, for better or for worse. So, for example, if people dwell on their fears, their anxieties, their sense of being let down by others, well, those neurons are firing, and guess what? They're going to be wiring merrily along. On the other hand,
so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly. And then, exactly as you're saying, creates these vicious cycles that become self-fulfilling. The other point, though, is that if we go the other way, if we focus on the positive facts in our world, seeing the world clearly, but seeing what's positive there, if we defeat the negativity bias of the brain, which is like Velcro for negative experiences, tough ones, positive ones, if we do that routinely, then we gradually, if we're, for example, self-compassionate, as you said, routinely, then we gradually build neural structures, even to the point that they're measurably observable with, you know, brain scanning technology. We gradually build neural structures, much like building a muscle, that are the neural basis for the psychological resources we care about, and the feelings we want of happiness, love, and wisdom.
Okay. Now, this is exciting because I think that the way that you're integrating contemplative work, psychology, neurobiology, and neuroscience, I've been talking to different colleagues and friends about some of the interviews I've been doing lately, and I've been very excited about the science because, of course, what's happening is Western science is finding its way to where some of the Eastern philosophies have been for thousands of years. And they're coming at it from two different places and arriving in the same pool of wisdom. And that's really exciting to me.
Oh, it is completely. And we live in an historically unprecedented time where, you know, modern kind of Western psychology and neurology is now coming together with the Olympic athletes of mental training, they're called, people in all the world's traditions, not just my own kind of home tradition, which is Buddhism, Christian contemplatives, Islamic, Jewish, Hindu, shamanic traditions around the world, indigenous peoples, and all the rest of that. And that's fantastic because when you bring those tools together that are hard won, you know what I mean? You don't get results on the cushion if you're not working hard and skillfully. Similarly, you don't get results in the lab unless you work hard and skillfully. Mm-hmm. You bring those together, then you've got that kind of toolbox plus operating manual, you know, that I tried to write about.
Now, when you say get results on the cushion, I'm just going to clarify that for our listeners. That's sitting in meditation.
Yeah.
So, I know.
Not on Valentine's Day. It's not a sex toy. Okay, good.
But although sex can be a meditation, and that's the thing is, you know, everything can be a meditation. And one of the things that I have found is it's the integration part, because as you said, in the lab, you can find statistical data, but if you don't integrate it, you know, on the cushion, you can find awareness and insight. But then if you don't get up and integrate it in your upright life, you get nowhere.
I totally agree. You know, one of the things that I've thought a lot about is empathy. Because when you look out at the world today, boy, you know, we need empathy. And in relationships, I'm a couples counselor and a therapists in general. And, you know, what brings people together is often that sense of really feeling close and understood. You know, people will say, gee, we used to talk, and I felt like he really knew me or she really knew me. And yet, over the long haul, empathy is, you know, one of the first casualties in a long-term relationship much of the time. And what's interesting is that science is now establishing the three circuits of empathy in the brain and how to activate those. And, for example, one of them, the circuit for tuning into the feelings of other people, is really energized by tuning into one's own body. So, for example, by simply paying attention, whether you're lovemaking or, you know, sitting on the cushion meditating, or both, who knows? But anyway, by tuning into your own body routinely, doing Pilates, doing exercise, doing yoga, going for a walk, whatever, by tuning into your own body routinely, you literally strengthen and thicken a part of the brain called the insula, which also tracks the emotions of other people. And to me, that's a great example of doing things inside your head through mental activity that change the brain and give you an ability that's really important, like being able to tune into other people.
Now, your book title claims, you know, a how-to for happiness, love, and wisdom. And you mentioned you're a couples counselor, and you've done some amazing writing in this book that validates a lot of the things that have come from these different traditions. But how do these, you know, virtue and mindfulness and wisdom, how do those create happiness?
What you're speaking about there is what's called the three pillars of practice in Buddhism. And it's interesting, too, that you find them, in other words, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom, in other traditions as well, often by the same name, which is pretty cool. And I think they're found across all the world's traditions, which are, of course, working with the same human being and therefore the same human brain, because those three, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom, map to the three fundamental functions of the nervous system of regulating, learning, and selecting. And so being good at those different things helps us, control our passions and act in a way that doesn't harm ourselves and others. That's the virtue part. It helps us observe our experience without getting sucked into it and to learn from our experiences. That's the mindfulness part. And last, it helps us kind of see what works and see what doesn't. I love the Dr. Phil question. How's that working for you? In other words, I mean, that's instant karma right there. You know, in this life, how's that working for you, for better or worse? Right. And on the basis of that, I think the essence of wisdom is gradually to give up lesser pleasures for greater ones. And that's the neural function of selecting. So if you think about it, those three functions, right, those three fundamental capacities to not harm ourselves and others, to observe our experience in the world and learn from it, and third, to make good choices, those are absolutely fundamental sources of happiness in this life.
Mm-hmm. And there's one more, which is sort of the antithesis of happiness, which is suffering. And when we return from our break, I think we'll go there. This is Healthy You Radio. This is Keisha Ewers.
Tired of running to the doctor every time you feel sick? Worried about a flu pandemic? What if there was a way to heal yourself and your loved ones easily? Take control of your health and wellness and learn Reiki. Reiki is a Japanese technique for stress reduction and relaxation. Become a Reiki master and teach others to heal themselves. You'll learn from longtime healer and Reiki master Keisha Ewers. Contact Fern Life Center in Seattle, Washington at 425-391-3376. That's 425-391-3376 to start your journey. To learn more, log on to fernlifecenter.com. That's fernlifecenter.com. Begin a path to healing now. And if you book a class of 10 people and mention this ad from Healthy You Radio, you will receive a free immune boosting kit valued at $25. Call 425-391-3376 today or log on to fernlifecenter.com and take charge of your health today.
Don't forget March 6th and 7th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Looking for new ways to find light, love, healing, and balance in your life, your family, and your work? You're not alone. I'm Jeanette Dames, host of The Soul's Edge, Tuesdays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. And I want to help you bring your life back to life. Listen to nourish your life or call for an angel reading. Join me on The Soul's Edge, Tuesdays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Are you looking for a way to protect yourself from colds and flu season? Come to Fern Life Center to boost your immune system with our rejuvenation treatment. Our professional staff of massage therapists will provide you with two of our highly acclaimed custom signature massages, two steam treatments in our traditional Indian cedar steam cabinet, and a Shirodara oil treatment. The gentle, long-gliding strokes of this massage and essential oils relax and increase energy while boosting the immune system and restoring balance to mind, body, and spirit. Call Fern Life Center today to schedule your rejuvenation package at 425-391-3376 or visit us at fernlifecenter.com. Receive special pricing on this spa package valued at $350 for just $280. So schedule your rejuvenation treatment today. Call Fern Life Center at 425-391-3376 or visit us at fernlifecenter.com.
This is Alternative Talk 1150. Got it? Cool.
Secret heart.
Healthy Radio. This is Keisha Ewers. Joining me today is Dr. Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And to start our show, we were talking about hormones and hormonal imbalances. And as we went to break, we were, if you're just joining us, we were talking about the practices that actually bring us into happiness. And I had said before we went to break that we might want to talk to a little bit the barriers of what keep us from happiness. So
right. That is the other side of the coin, isn't it? And one thing I might say that would be helpful here is this metaphor that's found in Buddhism. And actually, I should say to start with that you don't need a Buddha to be a Buddhist to read my book. It really respects that particular ancient wisdom. But it really is the idea that if you study the brains of people or study people who are really good at anything, that's a great way to get better at it yourself. So if you're interested in becoming happier and more peaceful and more effective and more loving, gosh, makes sense to study people like the Buddha, say, who really, exemplify that in this life. So anyway, from that tradition, there's the metaphor of the two darts. It's the idea that life has its inevitable and unavoidable difficulties, preeminent among them, old age, disease, and death, and certainly emotional difficulties like the loss of loved ones. And there's no way around the first darts in life. I mean, yes, there's a place for trying to minimize them and protect ourselves from them. I mean, I'm all for painkillers, And I'm wearing shoes when I'm walking across stony ground. But there is a minimum, and so it comes. And then the question becomes, do we also add misery or insult to misery or whatever that is, insult to injury, by throwing second darts ourselves? And that's where we get in. Those are our emotional reactions, where we get mad at the first darts, or we get angry that we're angry again, or something like that. And the opportunity here is to not throw those first darts so much, but to rather develop more of a sense of a kind of faith, a sort of solid base of unconditional basic well-being and kindness for other people that looks out at the reactions that are flowing through the mind like storm clouds, right, and can let them come and go without getting too caught up in them. In other words, when the really pretty clouds come through, not getting all caught up in them, but really understanding that pretty clouds come and go. And then when the nasty ones, the rainy and lightning-filled ones, come too, where we're mad or we're afraid or we're ashamed or we're sad or we feel guilty or we worry about the ones we love, when those clouds come through, that we also let them come and pass away. And as the clouds come and go, the sky endlessly remains. And that's the feeling that one gets increasingly through practice. And there are many kinds of practice, different practices work for different people. I think that's really important to, as you were saying on one of the breaks, in Ayurvedic medicine, it really appreciates individual differences. In the language I use, I talk about neurological diversity, that there are many, many different kinds of people, and there are many different paths to establishing that kind of base and spaciousness of mind, which I tried to write about, of course. But, more than anything, I think the point is to do what you can in your own place. I mean, there's always something a person can do to cultivate the conditions. It's like cultivating your own garden inside your own head, which means inside your own brain, that will gradually pull weeds over time and grow flowers and fruit.
very nice analogy or metaphor. You know, the thing of it is that people will talk about needing to be in control. And sometimes we're not even aware that what we want is to control the universe. And, you know, anyone that's lived any time on the planet knows that that's impossible.
Yeah.
And really, we don't have control over how many of the sort of negative situations we'll find ourselves in this world. But we can control how we react to them. And I think that's what you're saying is you control your reactions. And that's an important piece because there's also a neuroscience to stress, you know, with the nervous system and how it operates under stress. And maybe we should talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
With the two choices, the two pathways that we can choose and the little cocktail of neurotransmitters that we send downstream when we choose one.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting to acquire that control over our reactions. Of course, it takes some effort over time. It's not backbreaking effort. It's a little bit every day. You know, I call that the law of little things, that little things add up over time for better or for worse. And so what works, of course, is to just apply oneself a little bit every day to things like, just as examples, you know, developing more of a sense of kind of observing spaciousness for one's reactions, focusing on the good that actually exists in one's life and inside oneself, and then, you know, letting those good facts become good experiences and taking up, you know, 10, 20, 30 seconds to really savor them so they get woven into the fabric of the brain and the self. Things like that can really make a difference over time. We kind of have to, you know, I've been a therapist a long time. It's made me more compassionate, but also tougher-minded. We need to earn these capacities by doing the work itself that will produce them. But on the other hand, the good news about that is that they're legitimate. You know, it makes sense. So, for example, about stress chemistry and so forth, as you know, you well know, we evolved to handle threats and also opportunities, and we have dedicated neural and hormonal systems that respond to threats and opportunities by, you know, chasing carrots or dodging sticks. The one that helps us dodge sticks is actually pretty preeminent because as we evolved biologically, it was more important to avoid sticks than to get carrots. Because, you know, if you miss a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance at one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, you know, no more carrots forever. So the sympathetic nervous system reacts to both sticks and carrots, but especially to sticks. And then when it does react, it sets off this whole hormonal cascade of stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline and norepinephrine and so forth. The problem is that we evolved to handle short bursts of stress, you know, to, you know, get away from the tiger one way and to have the stressful moment end quickly one way or another, right? But we did not evolve to have the modern age of chronic stress, including low-grade chronic emotional upset. Because it's important to realize that when we're upset, when we're worried, when we're sad, when we're mad, even just irritated or exasperated or frustrated, wham! That lights up the sympathetic nervous system and the related hormonal systems like a Christmas tree or a Hanukkah bush, depending on your, you know, orientation. And so the important thing to do, I think, is to really appreciate the pernicious effects of chronic stress on both physical and mental health over time, and also the way that they're wear and tear in relationships, and to take up arms against them. To, in other words, focus on things like the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, which I dedicate a whole chapter to, which is the antidote to the sympathetic nervous system. And also to do things like gradually focus on positive facts and internalize them over time and taking in the good so that those become resources for resilience and resourcefulness.
You gave a couple of tools in your book that, again, I was very excited about. HeartMath Solution is a really wonderful book that was written many years ago, and from that evolved the HeartMath Institute, and really great research has come out of there. And there's a wonderful little stress reducer tool that they use that I use in my clinic, which is the M-Wave, you know, stress reducer, and it's biofeedback. And it shows people, you know, that chronic gas pedal of the sympathetic nervous system, what it's doing in the body in real time. And teaching them, you know, a practice like meditation and integrating that with the biofeedback tool is a great way of pulling your foot off of that gas pedal and learning what it feels like in the body.
Yeah, it's great that you do that. And it's a great example of how just a little bit of mental activity on a regular basis can produce very far-reaching changes in these fundamental biological systems of the human body.
Well, let's talk about heart rate variability, because that's an important component as far as longevity goes in a lifetime. We all want to live long with good quality of life. None of us really want to live long with bad quality, right?
That's right. Well, most of us don't. There are a few people who get off on being morose.
Maybe sure. I'm projecting here.
My friend and teacher James Barris says, well, that's their way of being happy. But anyway.
There you go, right. There's some feed. There's some sort of payoff they've gotten from that that's in their right. lifetime that they haven't figured out yet, but yeah.
So, well, heart rate variability, it's the idea that when the heart beats, there's a little interval between beats, and that interval is continually changing. So, for example, if a person has 60 beats a minute, the interval between the beats is not always exactly 1 second, like a metronome. And in other words, maybe it's 1 second, then it's 1.1 seconds, then it's 1 second, then it's 0.9 seconds, then it's 1 second again, and so forth. And what a lot of research has shown is that that interval called heart rate variability, or HRV, that interval is a marker for, under certain conditions, good health and longevity, and on the other hand, it's a marker for, you know, poor cardiovascular health as well as poor immune system function and so forth. What the HeartMath Institute, as you know, has pioneered are various kind of mind-body medicine methods for getting heart rate variability in a really good zone. The question, of course, is to what extent is heart rate variability just a kind of an indicator, like on a dashboard, you know, a needle, a dial that shows how well other systems in the body are working, or whether heart rate variability is, you know, a causal influential factor in its own right. Mm-hmm. But in either case, sure, by doing methods like I talk about in the book, or certainly the HeartMath Institute has a lot of variations on these methods, you can really affect that yourself. So maybe I'll just say the method really fast that I used as a kind of summary of a lot of different methods from the HeartMath Institute. One, breathe in such a way that the inhalation and exhalation are the same length. Usually we inhale quickly and exhale slowly. But in this way, you just like do a mental count up to, say, 4 or 5 for both the inhalation and the exhalation so they have the same duration. That helps even out the interval between the heartbeats, because when we inhale, the heart rate speeds up, and when we exhale, it slows down. The second thing to do is to sense your breathing in around the area of your heart, which, you know, sensitizes the neural networks that are linking, you know, the brain and the heart together. And then the third thing is to focus on some kind of heartfelt feeling, you know, a very oxytocin-producing feeling, like gratitude, or I bring to mind my children. Our children, our son's 22 and our daughter's 19, roughly about the age of your child. And so if we do all those three things, these studies have shown that it puts that heart rate variability into a really good sweet spot.
It's funny because when I work with my patients on this, I go through this program that you just talked about, and I'll try not to feed them ideas for what to breathe into their heart center that brings them gratitude, because what I found is my youngest daughter was the one that I would pull into my mind, her when she was a baby with this, you know, halo of golden curls and sunny smile, and it was like breathing sunshine into my heart center, and I'd immediately relax and be calm. And I started noticing that I would get calm for a minute and then go back to tense again. I thought, well, what's going on? And it was because she's just turned into a teenager.
I was wondering.
Exactly. And all of a sudden I'd think of the eye roll and I would go, oh, tense, because I'm, you know, quotation here, losing my sweet little innocent daughter. And all of us that have been parents know that they have to go through this individuation, and that's what happens. And then they come back into it. But I saw that I had to go to the beach instead of to my daughter for a while there.
Yeah.
Very important tools to find what makes us happy. So we're going to take another short break, and when we return, we'll talk about how to work with people who have anxiety and those morose feelings and what I call ants, or automatic negative thoughts. This is Healthy You Radio.
Do you ever wonder why some people can eat anything and never gain weight, and others just think about food and gain weight? Why do some people get depressed, have memory problems, develop arthritis, and others don't? Are you having problems sleeping or have digestive issues? Ayurveda has the answers. Ayurveda is an ancient system of medicine from India that has been made popular by Deepak Chopra. It explains why we are all different and tells you how to take care of your unique body type. Don't have an Ayurvedic doctor near you? Keisha Ewers is an an advanced registered nurse practitioner who combines the best of Eastern and Western medicine and will do phone consultations or workshops in your area. Get your business and personal relationships on track with her fun and witty style of diagnosing dosha imbalances. Get balanced in all areas of your life. For more information, log on to fernlifecenter.com or call 425-391-3376. Call now to set up a phone consultation with Keisha and receive the book, Perfect Health by Deepak Chopra, as a free gift from Healthy You Radio.
March 15th from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m.
Is your romantic relationship lacking zest? Are you having trouble remembering what the reasons were that made you fall in love with this person in the first place? Keisha Ewers and Ajay and Boris will teach you to have the partnership you have always wanted. Make your relationship a pathway to the sacred through the ancient practice of Tantra, or seeing God in everything and everyone around you. Learn techniques to heighten your awareness and bring juice back to your love life. Relationship is the ultimate path to growth and can bring great joy as well as great pain. Keisha and Ajayan will teach you how to use your partnership as a catalyst for growth. Start your journey by booking a workshop in your area. Call 425-391-3376 or log on to www.fernlifecenter.com. Call now to book a class of 10 or more couples and you will receive your tuition free. Have the sex life and love you have only dreamed of. Call today, 425-391-3376.
Real people, real life, real radio. Really? Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back to Healthy Radio. This is Keisha Ewers, and today we're talking to Dr. Rick Hansen, the author of Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And as he mentioned earlier in the show, you definitely do not have to be Buddhist to read this book. It's about neuroscience and the effect of the brain on your emotions and your hormones, and it's very good science. So welcome back, Dr. Hansen.
Thank you.
I wanted to really touch on why the brain detects negative information faster than it does positive information. I mean, I really believe the brain retains negative information like a steel trap, and positive information can go through like a sieve, you know, and it creates that automatic negative thoughts or ants. And it seems to permeate a lot of like my patients' lives when I'm working with someone with anxiety. You know, it's always about the fear of what could happen, and it's this negative reaction. And it's very hard to get someone to develop that attitude of gratitude that you were talking about before. So why is that? Why do we have that steel trap mind for negativity?
Yeah. Well, because in evolution, the thing, sticks were more important to pay attention to than carrots. You know, and so, you know, the nervous system has been evolving for 600 million years. And along that long journey in very lethal environments where literally, of, you know, all the organisms born on day one, you know, 98% were dead on day 100 or even day 10. Mm. So in that kind of environment, it was really, really important to pay
attention. Are you
there? Oh, yeah, both threats like predators and physical hazards, as well as threats within the primate troops we evolved in. So there literally are dedicated systems, like the amygdala, as you know, sort of the alarm bell inside the brain. About 70% of the cells of the amygdala focus on negative information. There are similar studies that show that when people are shown pictures of faces for about 1/10 or 2/10 of a second, in other words, faster than they can consciously recognize them, people are better at recognizing angry faces, or fearful or disgust faces that look, have an expression of disgust, than they are smiling, loving, or happy faces. So those are just some examples. For me, the takeaway point is to recognize the way in which the brain is stacked for passing on gene copies, but it's stacked against quality of life. And if we're interested in the 21st century in quality of life, it's important to take our brain on, you know, by doing little things every day, like we've talked about, to use the skills that I get into in my book, and certainly other people like Dan Siegel, who's a colleague and friend of mine, I've written about, to train the brain over time. The other thing I want to say in passing before we end is that we've got caveman brains with nuclear weapons in the 21st century,
mm-hmm.
and that's a very scary prospect. And mm-hmm. I think opportunities here is for people to use the emerging knowledge about the brain to be able to get more control of the way that anger and fear drives global conflict and the abuse of all kinds of, literally often millions of people.
Well, that's one of the things you said at the top part of the show, that we can't do a lot to change the world, but I would actually disagree because of the concept of mirror neurons. And so if you individually take the time to really control your reactivity and where, how much time you spend in anger and anxiety and worry, and you know, you will have an impact on the people around you with this mirror neuron concept, because your vibrational, you know, presence will affect those around you. And so I think just by doing that, we can really make a change in the world toward that, because you're right, it's a scary concept to have, you know, the caveman brain with big hairy weapons like that.
Yeah, I want to be clear with you. I think there's much we can do to influence the world through all kinds of vehicles, including sort of, you know, honestly, the vibration around us personally,
right,
that affects other people through many systems, including mirror neurons. There also are other, in many ways, actually more influential systems in the brain that track, you know, the state of other people, both what they feel and what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The point I was just making is that our influence on the world is inherently fairly limited, but our influence over our own mind and brain, which can then in turn influence the world, is huge, particularly if we do lots of little things every day.
So it's really important to rewire those negative attitudes and cultivate love and compassion.
Right,
you know,
and not be hopeless, you know what I mean?
Right.
I think there's a lot about the world today that can make people despair or feel hopeless, and there are ways in which governments do things to kind of cultivate an attitude of helplessness and hopelessness and kind of giving up in the populace, because it's a great way to get a kind of a cooperative and, you know, obedient populace. I think it's really important for us all to recognize there are so many things we can do inside our own heads and so many things we can do to take better care of the people all around us, you know, in our own immediate circle. And based on that sense of efficacy, you know, that we're a hammer, not a nail. In other words, we're the cue ball, not the eight ball.
Mm-hmm.
We can go forward in this life and really benefit so many people around us.
Well, there's another saying that I've really loved in the past, and it's there is I in illness and there is we in wellness. Mm-hmm. And I know when I was in Australia, the Aboriginal people there had no word for I. It was only we.
Yeah.
And, you know, really living in that sense of the empathetic brain that you talked about. You know, what is the role of empathy and love in a healthy mind?
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that, for example, broadly defined, it was love, really, that's driven the evolution of the brain over the last 100 million years. That's pretty cool. It wasn't war, it wasn't tool using, it wasn't conflict, it was love. You know, bonding between mates to raise children, you know, that's what mammals and birds do. And then, you know, connecting with other members of the group, that's what primates do. And then working together as a team during really tough conditions as humans evolved over the last 2-3 million years. That's what we do. You know, and along that long journey, it was getting good at relationships that really led to survival advantages that were then passed on in our genes. Isn't that kind of cool?
It's so cool, and I think that's the gift we can give our children. You know, if we can be better parents and better partners, you know, inside of our own family units, then we role model that to our children, and that passes that on.
I completely agree.
So thank you so much for joining us today. I know that there are some foods and supplements and some exercises that you can do to strengthen your brain. And so I'd refer people to your new book, Buddha's Brain. And then also this weekend on Saturday, February 20th, we have a meditation workshop at Fern Life Center. And we'll be also teaching breathing exercises and meditation. Really, time spent learning how to have an attitude of gratitude and mindfulness and insight is going to create the evolution of consciousness necessary for our planet. So this is not little stuff. It's big stuff. And I really thank you for the work that you're doing.
Oh, and the same is mutual for me as well. I mean, I've had a lot of interviews, and this was particularly moving for me personally.
Oh, well, thank you. And blessings to you.
Yes.
So, thought for the day. Most of us have jobs that are too small for our spirits. So says Studs Terkel. If you really stop to think about this quotation, it's rather shocking because most of us do have jobs that are too small for our spirits. So what this means to me is that many of us are operating at one half, one third, or even one quarter power or less. And we already know that. Statistics show us that we're not using all of our brains. So it means we could be doing, accomplishing, and contributing so much than what we are. So dream big and live up to the size of your spirit, which is limitless. Really access that potential that's in you. Join me next week as I talk to Marie Rose Fonlay about the Healing Planet Project. Her goal is to utilize and create media as medicine. Want to know how you can change the world? Tune in next week, Wednesday at 1 p.m. Here's to your health.